Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Nick Jones, CEO of Zumo, and Eddie Robb, commercial director at Zumo. Hey, guys, good to have you on the show. How's everything going today?
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Hey, Richard. Yeah, really good. Thanks for having us.
Let's kick off the show, and maybe both of you can introduce yourselves and give us a bit of background about yourselves.
Because you said, Nick Jones, I'm one of the founders of Zumo, and I'm also the CEO. We founded the company at the end of 2017. This is my third startup from scratch, albeit the other two were tech-enabled service businesses rather than product businesses from scratch. So yeah, third time around, first time doing a direct-to-consumer-focused product business, which has been exciting, particularly in the space that we're working in, emerging technology and kind of growing consumer acceptance and interest in the crypto space. So super exciting space to be in. We're growing unbelievably quickly, both in terms of our operational capacity and users. So yeah, it's very exciting times for us at the moment.
How about yourself, Eddie?
Hey, so I'm Eddie Robb. I'm the commercial director now at Zumo. My background beforehand was I ran my own tech startup. It was in the group payment space, B2B2C, selling into ticketing and travel. And it was during that business where I met Nick. Nick was my chairman for a while. And then when that wrapped up a few years ago, I joined in as a consultant initially to help on the B2B side of things with Zumo, building out the partnership strategy and what we're going to do around that front. And now since fundraising, I've come in full time and with a view to, you know, rolling out the products on the B2B side of things. Crypto isn't a space I was familiar with at all before, but it's definitely a very exciting space and one that I've got my teeth into now and can see a lot of opportunities for businesses to make the most of it.
Great backgrounds. And, you know, you've both had, it sounds like, interesting paths to finally landing up at Zumo. And maybe we can explore how these experiences, Nick, on your side, starting three startups, how these experiences have been of benefit to Zumo. And also on Eddie's side, also, you mentioned you've run a startup and how these experiences are helping you scale quickly at Zumo.
So from my side, I'd say probably right back to the beginning when I started my career, my kind of career properly, I moved to London to work for an American tech startup in 1999 that was one of the very first commercial search engines, a business called GoTo.com. And it was an interesting time to be launching just as the dot-com bubble was bursting. There were still lots of people out there telling you that the internet was a fad, that it was never going to take off, that it was just about crime and fraud, and that no one was ever going to want to spend their whole time sitting in front of the internet. I remember being laughed out the room by many marketing directors telling me that nobody would ever pay to have somebody click on their search result. And, you know, it was clear at the time as businesses were coming through in that era with really solid business models, and instead of people kind of not wanting the change or having their cheese moved and objecting to that. And then I guess as I progressed on that career, I was kind of lucky enough to be around the company I worked for was bought by Yahoo. So I was around to launch the world's first mobile digital advertising network on Yahoo. And then when I started my first agency business, we were there right at the very start of the kind of meaningful commercialization of Facebook and social media. We built one of the first Facebook ad PMDs. And then sort of further down the line in my investing career, kind of really got into the machine learning and big data space. So I think probably for me, the most valuable thing for setting up Zumo was having a sort of a nose that had been developed over a period of time that now was the time for blockchain and for crypto, that it was going to happen, that there was enough forward momentum that, and listen, there's going to be another few years of naysayers and people who tell you it's a scam, and there's still a lot of there's still quite a lot of that around, and the industry needs to market its own homework much harder. But it's happening, and we can see that all over the world at the moment. So I suppose first and foremost is this a real opportunity? Is it something I want to actually get involved in? Would be number one from experience. And then I think the other ones are more just down to the other kind of big things for me is about, I suppose, is about building a company. So, you know, I've always worked in kind of culture first environments from working for US companies when UK companies weren't really doing that. So we put a lot of time and effort into kind of defining purpose and values and making sure we have a culture which people can choose to buy into or not, as the case may be, if they don't want to work at Zumo. But having that really clearly defined and having that, doing that early, make sure that cultural stuff is set early, and also just the value and understanding the value of team and the kind of craft of building a team of individuals with lots of different diverse skills, but the ability to share a kind of common purpose and move forward with that. So I think probably that they, I mean, there's others in terms of just understanding how scrappy you have to be to get through the first three years as a product business without any revenue. But I think probably those would be the main learnings. So understanding opportunity and then understanding the value of culture and people and trying to build a team would be from my side. What about you, Eddie?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the struggles and the fight I went through with my startup, you know, it brings a lot to what we're trying to do at Zumo on the business side. So my startup was all about solving the problems of group payments on site. So initially targeting the ticketing space, so people going to gigs, et cetera, as a group, or the travel space, going on holiday together. You know, a lot of similar challenges are going to be faced with, you know, rolling out the Zumo e-commerce payment gateway and point of sale to that extent, you know, where we're, you know, talking to major enterprises or varied sizes companies, but building the leads, the generate that side of things, building up the sales pipeline, except that's what I really led in my startup. And a very similar conversation around, you know, talking with the people who are in charge of the payment side of things and making sure it's on the right side, but then also building out a product that once it's on the site that people are going to use. Like, we went through the pains and tribulations, the trials and tribulations of that by, you know, signing some pretty nice deals in my startup, but then not being in the right position on the website and getting uptake, not, you know, not having a smooth enough user experience. All these, you know, pretty obvious things now I look back at it, but there's a lot of lessons learned in that, you know, I am bringing to the table with Zumo, with our e-commerce payment gateway. So the gateway that we're rolling out there is that we know that consumers, our users, want to be able to spend their crypto, but a lot of businesses aren't yet in the market to be accepting crypto. So we have a convertible gateway, really. So as soon as the customer can select which crypto they want to be paying in, or indeed they can do it in fiat as well in the local currency, but they select which currency they want to pay in, and the company just gets paid instantly. So we do an exchange in the background, gets paid instantly into the currency they require. Now, likelihood is that it's going to be local fiat currency, but as we move forward, they may want to start collecting some of it in Bitcoin or Ethereum, with the options open to the client there. So they're the things, I guess, the main points I'll be directly bringing to the role here at Zumo, and hopefully fast track some of the problems I made, the mistakes I made over in my startup.
Yeah, some great stuff that both of you obviously are bringing to the fore. And maybe I'd like to touch on one point, and it is interesting that you raise this point, Nick, culture. And you've looked at that as a first step rather than maybe a mid-step or a later step. How is this actually helping you right now? How's this playing out? You obviously approached a culture first. Let's get that sorted out. Yeah, I guess, how's this playing out? How is it helping you bring in the right people and move forward quicker?
I think if you can define a purpose for a business, and that can be a kind of an honest purpose and an honest goal, whatever you want to call it, picture of success that you're all working towards, and be very, very open with the team and share the vision with the team, then that's the foundation of the culture, because culture is based around people deciding that they're going to buy into, that they're choosing to buy into a shared vision for success and buying into that success. So I think doing that early allows you to open up a number of benefits. One is, you know, do you have people who buy into that, and are they going to do the hard yards with you? But also, you're going to attract people who share kind of the right behaviors in terms of how they want to work. So, you know, very early about setting the vision for the business. And then we have involved the company kind of at every step of the way. So our values are not some made up marketing nonsense that someone's handed down to the team. And that was crafted and worked on by the team as a session. So the values were all originated based on behaviors based on when we've seen people delivering their best work in the company and said, okay, well, those are the values we need to be living every day. So again, this stuff is tangible if it's believable and if people can live it. Where it doesn't work is if it's kind of just marketing drivel handed down to employees, aspirational. And people make the mistake of making it too aspirational. Actually, you should focus on, from a culture point of view, focus on behaviors that people in the team are already exhibiting that you can have as a reference point for people to stick to. You know, I'm a huge believer in that. As I say, it's the advantage of having worked for an American company in the late 90s and early 2000s rather than UK companies who are still not really there at that point. And I've tried to create those environments with varying degrees of success in companies that I've founded. I think with this one, you know, I'm very, very conscious of the fact that, you know, the whole workforce now, barring people in the senior management team, is kind of the generation below me, or possibly even the generation below that, so millennials, zennials. And motivations are not the same as they maybe were for my generation, which were probably more financially orientated, if we're being really honest. So just being pragmatic, as well as believing it makes it a nicer place to work, you're more likely to retain and attract the best people if you have a clearly defined purpose and culture for people to buy into. And then you have to live it and make sure it's an enjoyable place for people to work. And I think so. I think both from a kind of a philosophical point of view, but also from a pragmatic point of view, if you want to hire and retain the best talent, then you need to be able to prove that you are, you know, culturally, you're going to be somewhere attractive to work.
Yeah, some really great points there, especially about, you know, talent and making certain that it's not that marketing dribble is actually actionable, and you know, you sort of live and breathe it from a culture perspective. I guess we've spoken a bit about Zoomo. You guys have mentioned you in the crypto space, but maybe, you know, one of you guys can give us a bit of a deeper understanding as to, you know, what problem are you guys looking to solve and why you're on, why you're here.
The main problem I think we're looking at solving here is the what we like to call the crypto curious. There's, you know, a lot of people out there interested in crypto, but it's a very complicated solution to get into and give it a go. And what we've done with the Zoomo app is make it a really safe but really simple and secure way to get into crypto, an on-ramp, so you can easily exchange fiat local GBP into that wallet and exchange it into cryptos of your choice, and you know, in small amounts to start with, to build up your confidence. And then thereafter, once you're, you know, storing securely and sending between friends your currencies, you can then some use from that. So that's where we have the B2B side, the e-commerce payment gateway, the point of sale payment gateway, to really be able to allow people to hold, store, and actually use the cryptocurrency in real life. Those would be the biggest problems, I believe. And then I'll start on that front there.
Okay, yeah, cool. And I mean, specifically, what target market are you looking at? Who are you aiming the solution at? Is it millennials? Yeah, who is it?
A bit more behaviorally driven than, you know, trying to be too hooked on a kind of demographic. So broadly speaking, our kind of go-to-market group for Europe, UK and Europe, is people who are kind of financially literate. Well, primarily they haven't yet taken the step into crypto, or they've maybe tried it and had a disappointing experience. We're not really focused on the kind of the power user or people who are looking at what the next crazy DeFi project they can get involved in. We're not really focused on those people. There's a ton of crypto related wallets and products that are aimed at the 1 or 2% of the global population who are really into crypto already. We're interested in the other 98%. And where we're starting is with, as Eddie's mentioned, this segment that we call the crypto curious. And there is a kind of millennial bias to it, but there's also Zennials, there's a lot of Gen Xers, and there's a number of boomers in this group as well. And then when I say it's more behaviorally focused, you're looking at people who are financially literate, so they manage their own probably ISAs, they do regular saving, they like, you know, share trading platforms like Robinhood, they probably do some credit, they probably like the idea of doing crowdfunding. And these are not necessarily big investors, you know, people are investing small amounts of money, but people who like to take control of their finances, like to be involved, and are, you know, literate and educated, and have really, you know, I think the last year has really kind of been quite a fundamental shift for a lot of people in that, because the kind of the incredible amount of money printing that's happened in UK, US, the markets where we really seen crypto growing, have kind of undermined people's faith in this idea that, you know, magic internet money is made up and real money is some kind of sanctity and is kind of uncorruptible. Well, I think we're seeing vast amounts of politically oriented money printing, and I think people's faith has been shaken. And, you know, and it's helpful, obviously, for us that we've had a, you know, that Bitcoin in particular and Ether have had strong years from an investment point of view. And this group of quite literate consumers are kind of suddenly they're open to it. And we, you know, we have tons of user stories about people coming on to the app, looking for the right application to try buying into crypto, going onto the app, realizing how easy it is, loading Sterling, buying 500 quid's worth of Bitcoin, and realizing that they don't have to do anything weird with it. They don't have to send it off and put it on a USB stick and hide it under the bed. They don't have to, you know, they can just leave it in your wallet, you know, and then log back in multiple times a day and watch the price go up and down and then decide to sell it again. So really, for those people, we're providing this type of user, that type of super slick user experience. You know, outside of that, I mean, there's obviously a number of use cases. I mean, that is very much sort of UK, EU driven. Yeah. As we're moving into middle, low income countries, emerging markets, you're still looking at people who are interested in tech and tech savvy and who've got probably enough income to have a be able to have a smartphone at the moment. But, you know, in those markets, it's much more, you know, really it's about the financial self-sovereignty angle. You know, it's much more relevant to somebody in Ghana or Nigeria or in Latin America to be your own bank than it is to somebody in the UK. It's kind of like a nice notion in the Western world, but in a lot of countries around the world where you have big issues with hyperinflation and central currencies going up and down, actually kind of a slightly different priority there, in that it's the idea of being able to own your own money in those markets, which is probably the strongest. So, you know, use cases vary in who we're targeting, but generally it is people who are, you know, kind of financially literate, interested in technology, kind of, you know, like to be early adopters, but they're not like real, they're not the kind of the real pioneers. They're not the real crypto zealots. It's a huge chunk of people fall into that group, you know, 20 odd percent of people we think. Fall broadly into that category. So, and that's our initial kind of go-to-market target focus.
From the B2B side, so from the e-commerce gateway or the point of sale gateway, it's really about connecting with brands that want to attract that demographic that Nick has just detailed. You know, it's a generally young, at the moment, young, growing and fairly affluent market customer segment in the UK. So we're talking with brands that are, you know, wanting to be able to communicate in a new with those guys and roll out this alternative payment option for them on their site. But as Nick was saying there, outside of the UK, we have some really interesting conversations around using our SDK to white label our solution, which is a combination of wallets, our exchange, and even the gateways for new countries. And developing nations are exactly where, you know, the benefits of digital assets really shine through. In the UK, it can be a bit fun and it's, you know, more secure, etc. But over there, then, you know, we've got some great movement going on in Africa. The benefits of cross-border payments, where, you know, a lot of remittances or cross-border B2B payments are currently up, or, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12-15% for those transactions. Whereas with a, you know, digital asset based payments cross-border, we can get those really low down, so around 1-2%. So that's where we're getting a lot of traction as well, down in Africa and South America and India as well. So you know, some real interest coming in that those directions. And that's our strategy with internationalization, isn't to go in and, you know, be fully regulated in that local jurisdiction, etc. ourselves. We want to find local partners that can work with us on banking relationships, on go-to-market strategies. And, you know, we have a sort of powered by Zumo solution there, which, you know, is in their branding with a little bit of ours in the corner to sort of show what we're about. But we're not too precious about, you know, holding on to the Zumo brand down there, because they know their, you know, our strategy is that they'll know the local consumer better than we do and how to speak to them better. And we have the technology, and we also have the experience from the compliance side of things being here in the UK. So yeah, that's the target market on those two fronts. You know.
Cool. I mean, so some really interesting insights there. And, you know, you guys touched on developed markets, i.e. in the UK and Europe, and also developing markets. So either moving or you've already moved out to Africa, South America, and India. On that front, I mean, how have you come up? How have you made the decision to expand across borders and go after these emerging markets?
I think for us, we always had this, that one of the goals at the start of the business when we originally started to build the underlying wallet technology was that we would build as an SDK that we would make available to other businesses, to other developers, because we built the business originally because we couldn't find a good wallet to integrate into a different product that we'd started building. So, you know, our motivation at the start was to build an SDK, was to build a white labelable product which other developers could use and would solve that pain. We decided very early that we would build our own consumer app focused on Europe. But having looked at, having spoken to, you know, a load of contacts and looked at what was going on in, you know, places in Latin America, in Africa, we really felt that the, and also looking at what was happening in the fintech world with how businesses were choosing to expand outside of the UK. And I think there's a couple of things that drove that. One is that obviously, you know, the traditional VC-backed route is that you, it's all about getting into the US market. But from an objective point of view, you know, that has some things that really don't appeal to me, not least the cost of going there. And if you look at the amount of money being spent by Revolut and Monzo on regulatory aspects and attacking that market, and they're all just hoping that there's going to be a winner so that they get the interchange fees. I don't think that, I think that potentially that funding model may have gone, because, you know, not everyone's going to get their money back. There's only going to be one or two winners of that group of neobanks, I believe. And they're all in, you know, they all have issues with profitability, which we know. So that kind of straight away from a pragmatic level kind of scared me. And I thought, well, hold on. If we believe that the big use case for crypto is really in low and middle income countries, why would we be focusing on a US rollout where there's all this density of competition and cost? So from a pragmatic level, well, let's look at the rest of the world and see, because obviously, you know, low and middle, there's massive development happening in many low and middle income countries, both from a tech infrastructure point of view. They're usually mobile first, and there's a very usually, if you look at a kind of global map of positive attitudes to cryptocurrency, it correlates directly with markets where there's issues with central banks and hyperinflation, etc. Reputationally, you don't have the same issues with Bitcoin in Africa as you might do in the UK, where you've got the FT telling everyone every week it's a scam and, you know, it's going to be not be around in a year's time. So pragmatically, those markets we believe are more open. They're also massive. You know, there's 1 billion people in India. There's huge markets there. But I think from our point of view is we wanted to look at what's the most efficient way to go to those markets. So, you know, if you're a CEO and you're looking at how do you spread globally, the issues you've got to chase are distribution. So how do I distribute my product as cheaply as possible? Because it's very expensive advertising any kind of fintech in any market. How do I deal with the regulator? Because it's very expensive and long-winded dealing with the regulator. Also, how do I really understand how what the use case is in South Africa or in Venezuela or in Bangladesh when I've never been to any of those three countries? and we believe that there is this kind of decentralization of use case and that it's very important for there to be locally geared products. So that's for the route that we decided to take, that you could solve all those problems by working with partners in these markets. And that is our tick box. If we're going to work, if we're going to try and roll out in a market, we need a partner who can cover the regulated aspects of the fiat element and KYC and the onboarding process. And we need a partner who can help with distribution. If we don't have those two things, we won't go to a market. So all of the rollouts that we're looking at are all based around having a partner who can take us to market, and either the same or a different partner who can cover the regulatory aspect. And then we can just focus on the blockchain and crypto bit in the middle.
Yeah. And as you move forward and you continue to grow and you continue to move into these markets and become a, you know, a household name, how do you balance the growth of your core business together with those additional initiatives, i.e. geographic expansion, product enhancements, et cetera?
Yeah, it's difficult is the answer. And I think it's just about being really, have to be extremely disciplined, particularly around validating opportunities. And you have to take them as far as you possibly can with as little resource as possible. It's the reality when you have scarce resource. I mean, we're about 30 people in the business, so we're still a tiny, tiny enterprise in the great scheme of things. You know, you have to kind of guard resource jealously, as you know. So that is around really having good people like Eddie around who will really, really, really take an opportunity as far as it can possibly go in terms of validation before we commit to building anything or putting budget at it. And that it was a real skill to kind of balance that, not under delivering on promises, but also wanting to push validation as far as possible. And not distracting, you know, being really, really, you know, ruthless with dev resource in particular, that we have a core product. We've got nearly 10,000 customers in the UK who we have to service and provide a great experience to. So it's about discipline, I think, and prioritization. And also from our point of view is just to go back to first principles of our business and to build as lean as we possibly can, you know, always. And if we're going to build a, if we're going to, you know, as Eddie's talking about, if we're going to, you know, do an MVP for cross-border payments, then it needs to be treated like a proper MVP. You know, we need to build it and as lean as we can and not kind of get carried away and get ahead of ourselves and start imagining that we're a massive company with lots of resource, which we definitely aren't. It's about not doing things as much as it is about doing them, I think is the reality. At the same time, it's about knowing when not to do it. Sorry, no,
at the same time, a lot of what we do in a way that can be used either, you know, in the UK or, you know, in our existing market, as well as overseas, and that we do it in the SDK manner so that it can be reused and repurposed. We don't go and do bespoke builds for bespoke pieces of work all in different parts of the cloud. There may be, you know, may therefore one of the features we had in our long list may be jumping ahead to where it would have been previously. But I think that's quite a smart way that we've been going about it, is making sure it can be multi-purposed and therefore it's not wasted if things don't kick off the way we want them to be. And, you know, as you're saying, it is about, there's a lot of exciting opportunities on the runway right now coming in, and it's about, you know, managing the expectations and just trying to push them along until we get to that point where, right, this is 100% a go, or there is always that little bit of a, okay, we're going to have to take the gamble here, or we don't take the gamble here. So, you know, qualifying it as best as we can before progressing, yeah.
Yeah, it's some interesting points you both mentioned there, and I'll pick one out specifically that you just mentioned, Eddie, making certain that you limit your bespoke builds. I think that's a key takeaway.
Yeah, it's huge. It's one I think I learned from previous time as well. We ended up with, you know, multifaceted different products for different clients all over the place, and it was a mess. The user at the end of the day didn't know what they were playing with, what they were doing, but then keeping that technically up to date is also very, very hard and time consuming and costly. So, you know, making sure we don't do that. And that's where you get best in class. You're not having 20 different messy products. You're getting one really, really great product. And I think, you know, with our tech team, our, you know, our, the co-founder, chief product officer, Paul, we're making sure we have really, you know, top of the class, top of the range technology there.
And as you move forward and look at different elements of growth, how are you measuring which growth strategies, well, I guess, yield a winning cycle? I mean, you mentioned partners. Is there some analysis you guys do in the background to make certain you get, you know, both the partner and Zumo get a full benefit from the engagement?
So I think, I mean, broadly speaking, we've had an analyst in the business from very, very early, which is quite a hard decision for a, you know, early stage startup to make, to bring in someone who isn't either kind of sales, revenue, front of house, or a dev. There's lots of stuff to build, but that was one of the kind of key roles, hires that we made very early because of the nature of our business. So we've invested in kind of human capital in terms of, you know, very experienced CFO, COO, but also this, you know, also having, you know, data science in-house, and then to start making sure that we make evidence-based decisions on as many things as we can. So we obviously have a lot of numbers that we can evaluate in our business, and those are growing all the time. So I think just investing early and making sure that I chaired in a very good data science business in Edinburgh, Aquila Insight, which I had, you know, was lucky enough to work around that business quite closely for the 4 years before it was sold to Dentsu. And I really kind of got an insight into what those guys could do in terms of, you know, BI, but then that leading into predictive analytics and prescriptive analytics. You really start understanding the power of using data, making it actionable. And we've just invested in that very early. You know, so we've just decided that, you know, we would try and make those evidence-based decisions as much as possible to try and, you know, to try and do the modeling and to try and own that and to try and have that in-house and to, you know, really, we're lucky we've got a great analyst who is very business savvy, as well as, you know, he's not just a maths guy. I think that broadly is it, is, you know, I think that you have to wean yourself off gut instinct decisions once you've got things live anyway. You know, I think the data piece, obviously you are following your, you know, I'm a big believer in intuition, because I don't, it's not any magic. It's just the ability of some people's brains to assess situations very quickly, and they are evidence. Intuition is actually evidence-based. So it's good to make quick decisions on some things, particularly if you're looking at opportunities. But I think once something's live, kind of going into a mode where you are much more analytical is what you need to do, again, to make sure that everyone's benefiting from those types of deals. So yeah, that would be my steer, is it, you know, just invest. If you're going to have a business that's going to churn out lots of data, get the structural piece right early and make sure you've got someone who can interpret it for you.
Yeah, some sage advice there. And as you, you know, you guys, I guess, are coming towards the end of the year, we're looking at, you know, 2021. What questions are you asking yourselves and factors you may be considering to make certain that you continue on that growth trajectory?
For me, with the international opportunities, is just continuing the validation on those. But then I'm also, you know, asking on the UK side with regards to the commercial gateway and finding who are the right partners for us. You know, like we have an inbound strategy where, you know, we have a lot of the companies looking to be bringing on the e-commerce payment gateway and the point of sale point of gateways. But for me as well, it's about aligning ourselves with key brand partners. I think, as Nick mentioned, a lot has gone into the culture, but we've also gone a lot to developing a brand around what our mission is. So finding partners, brand partners that will help sing that brand further, people who want to be associated with, as we mentioned, that crypto audience, that growing crypto audience, and trying to find those guys out and who's real and who's, you know, who's really doing what they're, you know, singing from their brand sheet, or who's just saying it for the marketing side. You know, we want to be aligning with the right people. So who they are is a big question I'm asking, and whilst also validating the African side further. Nick, and then dad on that? I'm sure you'll have more.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose for us, it's we're coming to the end of a 6-month period where we've done a massive amount of testing around different marketing tactics. You know, I think we are really interrogating that at the moment. And we have our final kind of big campaign going live on the 23rd of December, which will validate a kind of final advertising or media stream, which we're, you know, we'll then look to kind of really double down on for next year. So there's a lot of kind of looking at what's worked and what hasn't worked and trying to be as honest with ourselves as possible about what's worked from a user acquisition point of view to make sure that we do more of that and less of the others. I think from my point of view, there's an interesting challenge, I think, for any, talking about the consumer app for a moment, there's an interesting challenge, you know, facing us and a lot of other app owners and operators, is that we haven't really yet done anything aside from having a really nice app that people like using. We haven't yet done anything from an engagement point of view to really try and drive frequency and to kind of explicitly nudge and drive engagement on the app. And we are conscious of not, you know, we don't want to be one of those companies on Social Dilemma 2 being talked about, you know, using nefarious psychological tactics to push users into, you know, becoming addicted to using our app. But equally, you know, we need to drive engagement for our business model to work. We're really microscoping what we do next year to drive user engagement without being some intrusive Web 2 style Big Brother company. There's enough of those already. So it's how do we maintain our Web 3, respecting people's data and privacy, but also, you know, drive engagement with the app. And mainly that's about having a great product and thinking about what people want. So we're doing a lot of looking at what users are asking us for at the moment. So things like the ability to set up an automated kind of a direct debit, for want of another word, although it's not, obviously it won't be a direct debit of anyone, to buy a certain amount of Bitcoin every month, kind of a standing order to buy 500 quid a month worth of Bitcoin. Lots of users asking us for that. Lots of users asking us about price alerts. We've obviously got our debit card scheme going live in January, which is a whole new dimension to the business. So yeah, it's really, you know, really we're just trying to evaluate as much as possible. And obviously the other thing for us is we're coming up towards Series A. We'll raise our A round in Q1 next year. So really the questions we're asking ourselves is how can we discover as much as we possibly can about what we should do when we've got, you know, 10, 15 million pounds to spend? How do we reduce our risk around that as much as possible by learning as much as we can now?
Okay, cool, guys. And also part of your journey and a lot of entrepreneurs' journey is learning all the time, continuous learning. And I always like to ask my guests, what books are they reading right now? What books have they just finished reading? Maybe Eddie, you can sort of kick off and then Nick after Eddie.
Yeah, sure. Well, mine's pretty apparent as to what I'm working on most of the time at the moment. A book was recommended to me by UK TI in Africa. Anyway, the book is How to Succeed in the African Market. So yeah, it does what it says on the tin. And yeah, I'm really focused on, you know, how we get ourselves into that space. But yeah.
How about yourself, Nick?
Yeah, I've just literally just finished reading 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. I'm a big Yuval Noah Harari fan. I think the Sapiens is probably the most important book I've ever read. And actually, I think probably on reflection, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century is probably even more profound. It's fascinating. It's a really fascinating read. Very, very challenging to read and really kind of makes you see the world in a different way. And I think particularly helpful as we obviously are coming to a period of flux at the moment. We're probably kind of seeing the end of the beginnings of the end of what's been the most successful system, far more successful than any religion, around kind of Western capitalism that we've seen over the last 100 years. You know, everybody in the world pretty much believes the same things, but it's beginning to creak a bit at the edges, as we're seeing in the US and we've seen in the UK with Brexit, and we're seeing in lots of places all around the world, and what's next and how that will change. So I'd really recommend anyone who's got an interest in humanity and in where we're going and what are some of the things we might be doing wrong to read that book. It's absolutely fascinating. He's also a historian, as am I by training, so I'm probably a bit biased, but it's fascinating. I can just drop another one in for, I'm a very, very late convert to podcasts, as most people like to wind me up about. I would really, really, I'm kind of addicted to Outrage and Optimism, which is really the best podcast I found, which is Cristiana Figueres, who was the scientist behind the Paris Accord, the Paris Environmental Treaty. She's amazing. And her and the other people on that, they have incredible guests, David Attenborough, including Yuval Noah Harari. And that is well worth checking out. There's a couple of hundred of those podcasts up there, and they're all almost all amazing, and they have people on from across the whole spectrum, from the CEO of BP to Republican politician. It's really mind expanding hour to listen to. So that's my two.
Oh, awesome, thanks for giving us that insight. And listen, as we wrap up the show, how can people find and connect with you guys and Zoomo?
Always happy for people to get in touch with us. There is a hello@zoomo.money email address, which is the best bet. That will always be filtered through to the right person. If it's a message for me, feel free to just put that in the title line. But yeah, that's the best bet. That will get routed through to the right person. If you can put a note in there what it's about, and then our ops guys will make sure that goes to the right person. Or you can always find us on DM us on Twitter. We're @ZoomoPay on Twitter. Or you can get us on LinkedIn as well. Email is probably the best bet. As I say, it's hello@zoomo.money.
Download the app and the app stores and both. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, brilliant. So thanks so much, guys, for giving us a glimpse into your world. It's been a fascinating sort of hour discussion, and really looking forward to watching your success over the next year and seeing what happens from an African perspective and how you enter that market. It'll be really cool to see you successful out there.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much.